Welcome, podcast listening trainees, to the Three Men and a Retrospective's look at the entire Mission Impossible film franchise. Join IMF agents Garrett, Matt, and Adam as they review each film in the Tom Cruise starring saga about Daredevil agent Ethan Hunt and his team of world-saving emissaries. Pay attention, trainees, as knowledge of all that is discussed will determine whether you are worthy of joining the Impossible Mission Force. So strap yourselves in, IMF trainees. The Percolated Media Mission Impossible Retrospective begins now.
Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, released December 16, 2011. Budget on this is $145 million. Box office, $694.7 million. Tom Cruise is back, baby. And this is directed by Brad Bird, making his third appearance to the Three Men and Retrospective podcast. We did Incredibles last year, and here we are doing Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. No numbers this time. Producers decided, you know what? We don't want to put numbers after the title because we want to make it feel episodic. Matt, you said that you went to this just for the preview of Dark Knight Rises. Is that true?
Well, I went specifically to IMAX. I would have seen this movie at some point because of the director, but the draw for IMAX to me was outside of the little teaser we got. It was the first like real footage we were seeing of the Dark Knight Rises. And to me, that was probably my most anticipated movie at that time. So any chance I had to get just even a glimpse of it, and especially with seeing The Dark Knight in IMAX, I wanted to see if that transfer staying power would be there. So that's what got me in the theater, paying an additional like $4 or whatever it was to see a Tom Cruise movie. And to be honest, I went in knowing nothing. Like, I hadn't seen trailers. I didn't see anything. In fact, I thought this was so much of a complete reboot, A, because of the subtitle, and B, when I heard Jeremy Renner was in it, I thought that Tom Cruise was going to be in it for 2 seconds and literally hand the mantle to him, and that's why they're retooling it.
Adam, you stayed away from this with a 10-foot pole, didn't you?
I stayed away from it, but you know why? Because I had a 3-year-old, and I had my son about to be born at the time that this came out. So going to a movie theater was not something that was going to happen because my wife wasn't interested in this really by this point. But much like Matt, yeah, I assumed that this was like they were doing with Bourne, that they were just handing the reins to Jeremy Renner, and I was like, don't need it. The trailers didn't interest me whatsoever, and I thought it peaked with 3. I thought it was a great finale with Mission Impossible 3. You know, the score was middling, but I thought that was the best in the franchise by a pretty wide margin, so I thought it was a good ending. This, I think I paid for it on Redbox when it finally came out later on that year.
Well, Paramount wasn't too happy with Mission Impossible 3. That thing made a little less than $400 million, which is incredible to call it flop. But so it's not really a flop, but it was a disappointment with Paramount. And the regimes had changed, and Brad Gray, he was intending on bringing in another Brad Pitt, to take over the Tom Cruise role and train new people in IMF. And that was getting ready to roll. And at the last minute, Cruise came in and his Paramount contract was up and he wanted to reapply. And here he is, and he gets Skydance to be a part of this as well. And of course, Bad Robot still attached. We'll get to the reasons behind that here in a bit. But this was almost a Brad Pitt picture. Adam, you said you had zero interest. Tom Cruise coming back, meh. Jeremy Renner, meh. But if Brad Pitt had come to this franchise and they had pretty much rebooted it, would you have been interested then?
Just to see how bad it would have been. I like Brad Pitt in certain things. I think he, you know, has got a certain lane that he can stay in. That's not an F1 joke for later on this summer. But in this kind of thing, no. I mean, Clooney would be a better choice, and that would be horrible. So, no, I just don't see Brad Pitt. But it would have got me to watch it, but not for the reasons Paramount would have wanted.
Well, I would go out of obligation because I have to support my Sigma Chi brothers in anything. But I like Brad Pitt a lot as an actor, but I've never cared for his quote unquote action movies. Not that he's done ton, but I think of stuff like World War Z, where I just thought he was the wrong person for that role. I mean, you could say that about the entire production, to be frank, but I think he works great as an actor, as a likable lead. Because part of the appeal of these movies is the Cruise factor with the stunt work. And there's no chance in hell Brad Pitt would do anything close to the crazy shit that Cruise puts his body through in the name of these productions.
You know, I'll say it as I'm thinking about it, and Matt brings up his smaller roles, and I agree. I think he'd be an amazing villain. You know, to me, Brad Pitt and Garrett, I think, agrees with me on this. I love him in something like 12 Monkeys, you know, to go back to that. But I think if Brad Pitt decided he was going to be a villain and go that full-blown route, oh, you'd have my attention, sir.
He definitely
said the same thing about Tom Cruise.
I was going to say, he needs a Collateral or something like that to kind of prove that he can.
Yeah.
Has Brad Pitt, outside of, in the context of film, I mean, 12 Monkeys, it's a kind of a reveal that he's somewhat of a villain, but I don't consider, actually, Fight Club proved he could play the villain.
I haven't seen it.
But that was another subtle reveal, too. So, Tom Cruise, he gets his way back on. And let's talk about Tom Cruise. Let's talk about where his career was at this time. When we started this retrospective, boys, I told you guys that Mission Impossible to him was kind of his Rocky, where every time Stallone's career kind of got in trouble, he pulled the Rocky rug out and everybody kept on walking on it because Rocky made him a star again. So Cruise's career from Mission Impossible 3 to Ghost Protocol, and this is in addition to all the bad press he was getting with everything that happened to do with Scientology and Brooke Shields and everything we talked about last week. But in 2007, he did a movie called Lions for Lambs, a movie I've never seen, actually.
It's not good, and he's a supporting character in it. It leads you to believe it's something like The Firm, where he's the main character, but it's not. It's another Robert Redford puff piece, well past the time anybody wanted to see that.
And then he did a movie that a lot of people really like. I think it's fair, Tropic Thunder. People really like him in that. I think they did too much with the makeup and everything. I think if he would have just gone in there as Tom Cruise, I think it would have been just fine. But he just kind of overdid it in that. He's good friends with Ben Stiller, which is why Stiller was able to get away with all the parodies he did of Cruise in those Mission Impossible movies prior. But
Cruise also did it to show he could kind of make fun of himself, which I think his publicist told him to do that to an extent. But I also think he knew, I'm going to be in a movie where Robert Downey Jr. is in blackface. So if this goes tits up, he will take the brunt of all the criticism. And no matter what I do, I will be okay.
Adam, you saw Tropic Thunder, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. That's one that, it's funny. The first time I saw it, I'm like, okay, this is fine. And it continuously gets better with watches. Part of it is almost like the Blazing Saddles type of thing of, you can't do this anymore. And I'm sorry, no, you can't. Yeah, not only do they have Robert Downey Jr. in blackface, they do the Simple Sam.
Oh,
you know,
that's right. Yeah.
So, you know, completely taking the piss out of people like Sean Penn. And yeah, Tom Cruise going full Harvey Weinstein is some of the funniest shit to me.
And then we get to a movie that is very important to this franchise because he did Valkyrie, which is where he met McQuarrie. Bryan Singer ended up directing that. I kind of have a weird emotional connection to that movie. I kind of like it. I know a lot of people don't. I think it is probably up there with one of Cruise's worst performances. But Adam, did you see Valkyrie?
I've only seen parts of it just because it was on TV. And I meant to, and I was like, eh. I got a hard time with historical films, just because of how much I love history and I need it to be accurate. And Tom Cruise in that role, I believe he tried, I believe he cares, but it's not for me.
Everything on principle, that movie should be excellent. It's a great bit of history, although it does have the problem of, we know this is going to fail. Uh-huh. So you have to get past that. But it is the worst example of casting a big name to sell a historical drama, because I think Tom Cruise, outside of the fact that his profile is pretty similar to Von Stauffenberg, he is so terrible in that movie. Doesn't even try to do an accent, which, to be fair, that movie's got the Braveheart problem of only like two people are doing German accents, but all of them are fucking Nazis. I think it's a huge vanity project, and he looks like it's impossible to look as anything but Tom Cruise. There was no immersion in that performance, or in that movie for that matter. And quite frankly, I think it would have been a better movie if either Christopher McQuarrie directed it or if Kenneth Branagh directed it and got behind the camera, because he looks like he's ready to fall asleep before every take. And he's also not doing, I don't think he's doing a German accent either. I'm like, is anybody going to fucking try?
Yeah, that was one thing about Cruise. I do agree with you where it is up there as one of Cruise's worst performances.
Look, when the marketing for that movie is, here's a photo in profile, look how much the nose looks the same. I mean, it's Ocean's 12. Hey, the nose plays. It's Ocean's 12. I mean, that's what they sold it on. I tried, but I love historical pieces. I need it to feel immersive, and I need to feel passionate about it. I could enjoy The Last Samurai for what it is. It's telling a story. This just seemed, I don't know, vanity project is what it screams. It wasn't for me. And it should have been. You put somebody else in that role, you get people that try, and you get a movie that I would love, but not with what they did.
We then move on to Night and Day with Cameron Diaz, Adam's favorite actress. Now, Adam has said his piece on Cameron Diaz. Matt, where do you stand on Night and Day?
It's disposable fluff. There's nothing memorable about it. It's a bad example of, I don't understand why you put them together. Like, was Vanilla Sky that popular to warrant reteaming them once again?
That was bizarre.
And also, the Hindi version is better. They remade it in India. It's much better. But it's also like the problem with Tom Cruise having little to no sexual chemistry with any of his ladies. And that movie's heavily predicated on that notion. So the fact that Cameron Diaz, who is not a good actress outside of like one or two movies that I've seen, has to be paired with Tom Cruise, who is kind of limited in that capacity, very little about it works.
I still stand by being John Malkovich. I think he's tremendous in that.
Yeah, I'll give you The Mask.
All right. Well, those movies did not do that well. Well, Tropic Thunder did, but not on his name. So, of course, he's going to go back to the Mission Impossible. Well, and that's what he does. And you're going to notice that Bad Robot Productions is attached to this, which means that we had J.J. Abrams. And yes, he was back. He brought in two of his writers from Lost to come in. And, of course, once that was done, people weren't that satisfied, so here comes Chris McQuarrie to pretty much rewrite the entire fucking thing. JJ was going to direct this, but his little passion project called Super 8 was being done. He left to do that. So he was still on as a producer. Him and his running mate Brian Burke are on as producers. We'll talk about Brad Bird here in a bit, but Adam, is the loss of JJ Abrams, is that big? I mean, you were big into the third one. Would you have liked him to have come back to this?
No. No, I wouldn't. And the reason I'm going to put at this point in the franchise, you have three movies. They are very different styles. You have three different directors doing it different ways. And I think that's a nice way to take this. So I don't bemoan him leaving. And based on any time I've seen JJ do a sequel to something that JJ did, how about we don't give him second parts of anything? I'm going to start getting on the back seat of Matt's bandwagon, you know, there. And I don't need him back. That's okay. I love three, but no, that's all right. Move along. I still haven't seen Super 8. I've heard it's fantastic.
I wouldn't say it's fantastic. It's No.
They should have called that movie Masturbate, because all it does is him jacking off to Spielberg.
Well, it's a little bit of that.
Don't scare it.
It's a little bit of that, but I remember I went to a screening of that, and I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't say it's fantastic. It did fall below my expectations, I'll say that much. But it's not as much masturbatory as much as it's just trying to tell a story in that style, and I don't think he does that very well.
No. As we have seen, Abrams is not great at imitation or recreation.
To be continued when we get back to him, when we eventually get to Star Trek. So they needed a director once JJ left. Bring on Brad Bird. Although before him, we had a couple interesting choices, boys. Matt, are you aware of these?
No.
One, a guy we're going to be talking about later on this year, Edgar Wright. He was brought up and interviewed for it. Mm-hmm. And a guy who has one movie that was a huge hit and has been chasing that tail ever since. A guy by the name of Ruben Fleischer was considered director of Zombieland. But they all passed on him, and Tom Cruise, huge fan of the Incredibles movies, and he was brought on. Now, Matt, as a huge fan of the Incredibles, you hear that he's doing this live-action Mission Impossible film. What are you thinking?
Well, between The Incredibles and The Iron Giant, I have a huge affinity for Brad Bird's work. But I was curious about him making the jump to live action. So that was a bit of a barrier I had to overcome. And the second one, he wrote both of those movies. He's not credited as a writer on this. So I was worried that he was just being brought in to point the camera and shoot it, but not put his own style on it. Because one of the things that worried me also with the subtitle is this just going to be a soft reboot where they stop emphasizing the directorial style, which the first three movies all do, and try to make something more commercialized and saturated? So I love the idea, but I was concerned about how much input he was actually going to be able to input on this.
He actually ended up having quite a bit, and a big thing that he did, we'll talk about when we get into it. But Adam, obviously Brad Bird's name didn't really get you going, not until he came out with that George Clooney bombastic, terrible film that you love so much. Brad Bird's name's mentioned. How are you feeling? Are you Does that make you any more excited? You gave Incredibles pretty high marks.
Absolutely love Incredibles. The less said about Incredibles 2, the better. But to Matt's point, he wrote them. He was involved that way. I've heard amazing things about the Iron Giant. But an animation director and live action director are not the same thing. It's like being a producer in film and a producer in TV. They're not the same thing. So I think it's a different skill set. But I was happy and excited to see him be brought along. But when I start to see that this franchise has now basically become a production company bank, which is kind of what it is, you're going to add a whole bunch of production companies to try to earn some money, it feels like he's going to be a shooter more than a director. And that can be okay, especially for a first-time guy to get his foot in the door and start to get some of those credits live action under his belt.
Movie comes out and it makes almost $700 million, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. And it helps Mission Impossible break the $2 billion mark as a franchise. So it's safe to say this was a pretty big success. I saw this opening weekend. I went with my former brother-in-law. We went to the theater. And this was a nightmarish experience for me because when I left the theater, I realized that, my wallet's missing. It was one of those moments. Fortunately, when I went back into theater, I searched for it. And one of the janitors had actually found it and he saw me looking and he brought it right up to me. So that was almost a really, really terrible experience. And I remember walking out of the movie really liking it. I had a good time with this one. It's not one I've gone back to, though. I haven't really rewatched it. Like all these movies, since me and Matt reviewed them all those years ago. But Matt, have you watched this more than the few times since before you and I did that retrospective?
No, this is the first time I've gone back to it since.
Okay, interesting. Adam?
I've seen it more than two. Trying to think, I've probably seen this three or four times. When it first came out on, as I said, on disc, I saw it. And then I was like, man, they did something. And then as new movies came out, you know, if you try to refresh yourself, you try to see it, but I won't say it's in the regular rotation, but yeah, I've seen it a few times.
All right, we open up with the Paramount logo, well as some more, including the Bad Robot logo, before jumping right into Budapest. And we're seeing a chase happen as Josh Holloway from Lost is being chased, and he jumps on a bag below, and then he's shot by Lea Seydoux before she takes the bag from him, and we pan out from the phone in his hand, which has her picture on it.
Quite is that a way where he's from, Lost?
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, so he's a JJ connection. That JJ explains connection. The new series.
Yep.
Okay. And I only know him from Yellowstone.
He actually was hyped up as being a member of IMF, and I was kind of looking forward to seeing what he does with him. He's dead here within the first 5 minutes. Although this wasn't going to be this way. It was going to open up into prison, which is the very next scene, but Brad Bird wanted to grab her. I think this is a good way to open the film.
It sort of is a good misdirect it's a better misdirect than how the second movie opens. And it's also considerably shorter for that matter. So I do like getting someone who was recognizable at the time. Lost was a big deal because a lot of people, including myself, watched it for no other reason than to talk shit about it. But right away, I think it establishes the more outlandish sensibilities that Brad Bird has. Apparently he loves, you know, over the top type of physics and spy mechanics, like the balloon or that mat is straight out of Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm.
What he jumps off the building, turns around, shoots the guys as he's falling down. I appreciate the establishment of a bombasticness with this movie, but it's also not an out-and-out cartoon, which I thought it was setting up, because he gets shot 5-6 times, and it's very matter-of-fact. So I think he's already showing that there's going to be a pretty good balancing act, especially compared to 2 and 3. Like even the first one, I would say tonally this is the one I vibe with the most collectively.
I would definitely agree with that. The other movies took themselves so serious, and this one definitely has a more fun vibe going with it. I would also say too, God, you know, I forgot that Lea Seydoux was in this, and I know we talked about her when we talked about Bond, but that was not her role. This is what she is. She's a villainess, man, and she is awesome in this movie. The few times we see her, I crave more of her, and that's the mark of a good villain.
I think she got better once No Time to Die came around, but I think this shows that Spectre just mishandled her completely.
Oh, definitely.
And for that matter, this, what surprised me the most was how much this felt, and this, I'll say it about this movie, I think it's the perfect hybrid of what I want from the best type of Bond films, mixed with the elements that I really respond to when Fast and Furious was at its peak. I think this movie is kind of the perfect blend of the two for my expectations, where it's not a cartoon throughout. You have an investment in the people, but there's also actual there's actual stakes that are set up. So I even though I don't feel like they're people I know directly that well, I still feel something if something bad happens to them. And we'll talk about this throughout the movie. I think this was the movie to make, it's a cliche now, this was the one to have a female villain front and center.
All right. Now, Adam, how do you feel about this opening scene? And how do you feel about Lea Seydoux in the villainous role?
I like the change up. You know, you don't know who, you assume you're going to open with Ethan and that you don't. I think it's a nice little piece. It shows that there's other things going on in the Mission Impossible world or with the IMF. So I like it. With Lea Seydoux, yeah, I think this is exactly how you use her. Minimally. And you don't let her speak. Yeah, use her less. That's the way to use her, right? So I think she's fine. I mean, she's got a look, and I don't see anything other than, you know, that she looks the way she does. She looks villainous. Other than that, and maybe because of how she was in Bond, I don't get the Lea Seydoux thing. But for here, for somebody who's just going to glare at the camera, then yeah, she's perfectly cast.
She was in a tremendous movie called Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard, and I don't need to see softcore Skinamax.
It's not. I mean, there's there's elements of it, but it's actually deep story that I highly recommend.
Well, that's not the only thing that goes deep.
But I do like that we're seeing different gadgets. We're seeing some fun spy work brought here to the point, you know, to the forefront. And to both your points, it kind of sets the tone for the movie you're going to have by opening this way. And I think that's important. Set the tone from the beginning of what to expect.
We go to a Moscow state prison as Benji clicks some keys and opens a door to a cell containing Ethan. We're seeing guards approach the open door as Benji opens more, and then guards are taken out as Benji mouths the word sorry. Benji plays a bigger role in this. Matt, do you like the bigger role that Simon Pegg is playing here?
Yes, but I was surprised to see him in the sake of, despite this having the subtitle, it's still another piece of this franchise. Like, it's keeping continuity, especially with the context of the third one. Like, this one picks up all the pieces that were left and does something different with most of them. But giving Benji an expanded role, I think, suits Brad Bird's sensibilities, because everyone in this movie has good lines. And because of that, Peg doesn't feel like he's here solely just for comic relief. While at the same time, you see him actually do respectable field work, so it doesn't feel like he's just there as the quote-unquote tech guy. So I endorse this, but I also said the same thing about Star Trek. I'm like, he's Scotty in name only, but I enjoy watching him so much that I don't care.
I think he does a good job. I think he's fun. He's believable. You know, they give an explanation that he's worked to become a field agent, and he's just getting started that way. I also believe that he and Tom Cruise, and therefore Benji and Ethan, have become friends. There's just something about the way that when they're on screen together talking, I believe these guys would hang out and have a beer, or for those at the other side to go and have a pint. So the chemistry works really well, and I think maybe that's why he brought him back instead of just Luther. You know, we get finally some other returns.
The guards are locked in as Ethan is still just throwing a ball against a wall, an obvious homage to The Great Escape, and then Benji throws on some Dean Martin. Ethan then puts the ball in the wall as he walks out, and we see that he has the same hair from part two here. He brought back the long fucking hair.
It's not as coiffed, but it's still, it doesn't fit his, especially the fact that he's 50 now. He feels like that guy who's just clinging on to his youthful days for dear life. I half expect him to still have that leather jacket from the second one. But I do appreciate that this is not a throwaway opening sequence, because it establishes two things. Why is he in this jail? Because that's an odd place for him to be in, given how the last movie ends, because he's retired and he's married. Mm-hmm. And B, they don't give you the answer to this and wrap and bring this back until the third act. So it serves function beyond just being a fun action sequence. And there's good comedy here, like where he's pantomiming to Benji on the camera to open the door. Like, I think tonally this one, it's light, it's fun to watch, but it doesn't, I don't have the Marvel problem with this, where I don't feel like the movie's stopping for quips. I feel like it's seamed in very well, because like I said, everyone has one-liners, which Marvel does have that problem. But here, they're also very competent at what they do, and I don't think the jokes go on for too long. Like, there's no running gags throughout this movie, except for one, which is we'll get to it in a bit, maybe my favorite thing that Brad Bird includes.
Benji is being told not to worry, as Ethan knows where the extraction point is. He He then keeps telling Ethan to go to the extraction point, and I'm liking the interplay here, as Matt just outlined. Ethan's holding a fist to the camera, and Benji says, fine, as he's opening the doors. And then Ethan is approached by a guy who towers over him, so I'm guessing he's about 5'7 or so. Ethan starts ducking punches and maneuvering through the prison doors as a riot breaks out. He has another prisoner with him as he's calling Ethan Sergey and is praying that there's more to the plan. Ethan fires another batarang and takes his new pal with him and tells him to light the fuse as the opening titles start. Hell of an opening title sequence, boys. Not only are we getting a tease of what's to come, but we're getting a nice little prison outbreak. I think this is rather fun.
I like the transition where rather than just doing a hard cut to the credits, they do the transition to where they spin the camera to the right. The effects blend in pretty well. I think this transition is actually really well done.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like that transition. It's fun that way, which is kind of the way it's kicking off. I got to say, though, I don't find this opening very dynamic. Other than the fact that he's just breaking out of prison. And, you know, think about these poor guards, you know, that he's opening all the doors for. Some of these guys just went to work that day. But I don't know. I want a little more for this opening. It's fine. There's some fun moments, but I think you could have left it before the prison and brought this into the other part of it.
I think it works for me because of what Matt just mentioned, in that we don't know why he's here. We're just seeing him get out, and we know that's going to be a tease for what's going to be told to us later. So it works in that way for me. There's more intrigue to it than actual action. And I'm not saying Brad Bird can't direct action. We'll talk about the fact that he can when we get to it. But I think here it works as an intrigue piece.
Especially there's a thought in your brain, is this a reboot entirely and they're just not going to mention that he has a wife?
Well, that's a whole other problem that we'll get to when we get to the end of the
movie. No, but it leads that question of like, is this just with the subtitle, are they just rebooting continuity and saying it's its own separate adventure? Like, are these going to be what the Bond franchise was for a long time where stuff can happen, but it really doesn't have consequence in the grand scheme of things?
Ethan is tending his wounds, and Benji tells him that he actually passed the field exam. And then Ethan shoots the prisoner he brought and then moves him to another van.
Oh, Ethan. One thing I want to bring out. These opening credits. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm going to rewind 30 seconds. I was blown away that the first credit, and it shows how the power dynamic changes. It is a Tom Cruise production. The number one credit is Tom Cruise production before Skydance, before anything else, before the director, before the other actors. Tom Cruise production. And that, I think, kind of says a lot. And I think it says a lot for the franchise going forward. He has fully taken control, and he is the secretary and agent going forward for this.
Yeah, no Paul Wagner here. 3 was her last gig with him. So, yeah, It's just a straight Tom Cruise production, which, you know, I feel the same way about that every time I see, like, an Eddie Murphy production subtitle. It's like, God damn, like, how much control do you need?
And this started to be a thing where there was lawsuits, and it's, you know, where the guilds had to come out and be like, look, we're only putting PGE for people that are actual producers, not just fucking buying their way in, not just putting their name on there for an additional credit. So it's this changed the movie industry to a point.
And it also changed the direction of this franchise, where you really get the sense that these are Tom Cruise first and foremost. But I'm also not saying that in an overtly negative way, because in this one, you do get the sense that this is a collaborative effort with the director and also with this cast. This is the most they've done and will do with a team up to this point by a wide margin. So I think it gets past that inherent notion you have of a Tom Cruise production that he's going to be front and center. He's here, he's the main guy, but it's not as on his shoulders as I thought it would be. Look, if they had him doing any more heavy lifting, they'd have to give him a footstool so he could take care of it. But for what you think it is with that credit, it's really not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ethan says that if the secretary wanted him out of prison, it must be pretty bad out in the field. He is then told that IMF lost a file because Agent Hannaway blew the drop and succumbed to some armed hostiles. And this is when we're introduced to Paula Patton. She's going to be our new female protagonist. Now, Adam knows, I am a fan of romantic comedies, but I haven't seen any of them that this chick has been in. And I know at this time, she was pretty much known in tabloids as being Robin Thicke's muse who ended up cheating on her. I think she's really good in this role, though. I do like her. I warm up to her. At first, I'm kind of cold, but I think she turns into one of our best protagonists.
Well, this is also where the paradigm shifts, where this franchise, I think, does, and I'm sure Adam will elaborate this, you're starting to see the women take on more of a substantial role in how they're a little bit more developed and have more to do than they've done in the past. And she's also, unlike Tandy Newton, she has a brain and is allowed to think for herself, sometimes to bad consequences, mm-hmm. but she's not derided or she's not used as strictly a sex object by the two leads. Like, she's a fully realized field agent without the mansplaining that can be associated with a lot of these characters, especially nowadays. Definitely. Like with certain ones.
I think this is when you see a change and you start to see that the impossible women are going to be used much more. Modern seems to be the wrong word, but maybe much more respectfully than Bond girls. And maybe it's the way that Tom Cruise is, but I think the impossible women from here on forth are a big role. I think it sets the stage for a lot of female-centric action movies that come out after this. I think Paula Patton is gorgeous enough that I would drink her bathwater, but I think she's also not just used as the sex object that Tandy Newton is, which was done insultingly with the way that they talked about that character. You know, or in the original, you know, the first movie where it was nothing but someone to sleep with and then get shot as the very typical Bond woman. So I think this is really where you see that demarcation line to the benefit of the franchise overall.
Hannaway says there's something he should have told her before he died, but she picks up his phone and sees the girl he took the picture of. She's revealed to be Sabine Moreau, a contract killer who works for Diamonds. A total Bond aesthetic. That is
Bond. Oh, yeah. Like, that's, she... Is she Miranda Frost?
Yeah. Hunt told Russian nuclear launch codes is what was located in the files that were taken. And then we're hearing that Ethan was in prison because he disappeared after he and his wife divorced. So, boy, this is a through line that just gets messed with. We'll talk about what was supposed to happen when we get to the end of this thing. Benji, though, says that he was being transferred and put on leave. There were rumors of an unsanctioned hit. Ethan is given orders to penetrate the archive located in the Kremlin to obtain Cabal's file. He's then told IMF have chosen his team for him. And then, all right, so, Matt, I know this is what you were talking about, and I love this, too. I love that Brad Bird brought this to this franchise. This is being told to him through a payphone, and it says it's going to self-destruct in 5 seconds. But when Ethan hangs up the phone, he walks away, and after about 7 seconds, it's still there. So he just walks over there and hits it, and it blows up. This is a huge thing in this movie. It's a through line that I love. Every single device here does not work.
Yeah, like this is a world where Q Branch is run by morons.
Yes.
Because none of the technology works, and that is clearly a Brad Bird touch. I guess Edna was on her off day and they got like her interns to do all this. But it's also like the movie doesn't stop for this joke. You get your exposition out of the way, which is a staple of the series. You nice touch at the payphone. Although even by 2011, those were hard to come by.
Yeah.
But it's also not a huge explosion.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. and we chose your team for you. And it just happens to be the two people you're already with. And more importantly, I think Brad Bird recognizes in a way that I think Ortsey and Kurtzman did not, that your plot device, like your thing that the villain's going to use, it's strictly a device. Like nuclear launch codes, that's as basic as it gets. Mm-hmm. My villain's going to blow up the world with nukes and we have to stop him. They might as well be Chaos from Get Smart or Dr. Evil's organization, where he's like, oh hell, let's just do what we always do, hijack nukes and hold the world hostage. Okay, that good with everybody?
And of course, given that this is a Brad Bird production, everybody's using Apple. There's Apple iPhones, there's Apple iPads everywhere in this thing.
Because he came from the world that he did. When mm-hmm. we rewind to the beginning, we see the ring, we see the A113 little Easter egg, mm-hmm. which popped me big for all those Pixar fans. I think it's a great fun way to do it, because it doesn't over linger on any of them. There's issues, there's problems. It's fun that way. I like it.
I love Benji's response to the idea of them going inside the Kremlin. He goes, wait, I thought you said the Kremlin. He's just kind of looking like, oh God, that is where we're going. We see a red balloon fresh from it as Benji and Ethan, they make their way in, and Benji is bitching that he is the only one who can't wear masks.
Well, that's the red balloon. To me, that was a cinema... That's such a throwback to classic cinema.
Of course.
I love seeing that red balloon.
Yeah, I do too. Matt, you and I really praised the scene last time we reviewed this. I'm going to praise it again. I love this whole scene of them going inside this Kremlin. I think the whole scene is suspenseful and it's very well constructed. And I'm going to go ahead and credit Bird on that. I really like the way they do this scene.
I do too, especially because the technology is not instantaneous.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate because they're getting scanned in and the card reader doesn't get overrided for a bit. They have to keep moving. I also like that the technology is futuristic and techy, but they don't go as far as like the invisible car from Die Another Day.
Yeah.
Like there is still a certain amount of groundedness, but they're also embracing, let's just have fun and come up with cool gadgets. And it's a fun way to get Benji involved without him having to shoot people, which they very could have easily done. They just break in, start tranquilizing people, hack into it. No, they're actually having to outsmart the Kremlin, which, given today's administration, that might not be the hardest thing to do.
Okay, I need to start off by saying, I don't understand the Kremlin mission. Like, I know it's told to me. I know it's broken down. I don't really understand the what, the why, all that. And I don't care because this shit is fun. The way that this is shot, the music going through, the cuts, it's got a beat to it. It's like playing music, you know? It's just, you're big bopping along. I think it's fantastic that all of this tech is, it's very Casino Royale in the way that it's a little out there, but it's not sci-fi. You know, it's believable, even though it's not. I really, really like the way this is done. As much as I'm like, okay, this is stupid from what I was told of why we're doing this, I don't care as soon as we are doing it.
Well, I think this movie, and to your point about the purpose of the Kremlin, this movie gets by on just its set pieces. Like, yeah. It shows that you can just have a fun spy movie that is not so preoccupied with tight plotting and still make it work. I think all three of the previous movies have simplistic plots that are either too muddled, or in the case of the second one, they get so bombastic that it's a clash. Here, I think it's a good balance where it's like, it's not that I don't care, but you're also not asked to... It's not that they're saying turn off your brain, But this is a movie that, like, CinemaSins would hate. Like, it's operating on its own internal logic and just asking you to have fun.
They're not asking you to remember it as it goes along. It's just like, hey, guess what? Here's the paint-by-number to the next scene. I hope it doesn't offend you, but don't spend too much time thinking about it.
No, they're just coming up with fun ways to go to do globetrotting from place to place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's like some of the fun Roger Moore type Bond films that way.
Yeah, or even something like Goldfinger, where people mm-hmm. love Goldfinger, but if you ask them what that movie's about, they're like, I know we watched The Poison Fort Knox, but that's about it.
I love that Peg looks like a kid in a candy store in this fucking scene. Like, he looks like he's having a blast while this is going on.
Little tease where he says, like, sorry about what happened between you and Julia.
Benji gets to go on a mission with Ethan, and Simon Pegg gets to co-star in a movie with Tom Cruise.
Exactly.
Talk about, you know, real life.
7 years ago, he was trying to graze up penis to make Shaun of the Dead, and here he is in this huge scene with Tom Cruise. Guys, this is the safe scene from the first one, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, kind of. It's also like when they have to get Philip Seymour Hoffman in the third one at the Vatican. Apparently breaking into the Kremlin is easier than breaking into the Vatican. So apparently the Catholic Church has better security than the Russians.
But they got more secrets.
I love this dripping water sound effect that Benji creates, and as well as the look on Benji's face as he catches himself and then moves off camera, which was fantastic. So they get to the safe, which Ethan infiltrates. He's looking through files and sees that the files are empty. And then we see Michael Nyquist?
I don't know how to pronounce it.
He makes his way in as Ethan calls to abort the mission. He walks right past Hendrix and makes a beeline through the tunnels as Ethan emerges and takes off his disguise. More balloons out here as kids roam around, and then the Kremlin completely explodes and blows Ethan forward. This was shocking to me. I don't remember this being in the trailers. I do remember the way I felt after I saw this whole thing just completely blow up.
Yeah, this takes stones to do.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't Independence Day where it's some weird sci-fi fantasy. You know, you blew up the Kremlin.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Bond, they blow up MI6, but they don't blow up.
Big Ben.
Parliament. Yeah, Parliament doesn't explode.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is, I mean, this takes some stones to even decide you're going to do this, especially in the political climate of James Franco can't do a fucking movie without pissing off North Korea around this time. So, but I love it because this is as unexpected as all hell. And I love that he's on a frequency where somebody else suddenly chimes in and you realize, why the fuck are they calling this team leader? Who the hell? Like, this espionage, I mean, this just ratcheted up and you have no idea. When you see him panic, we get to be panicked along with him. And I love the quick change as he's going through and exiting. This is great stuff.
I also like that they're sort of, in a lot of ways, this kind of is a soft reboot because this premise is doing the first one to a certain degree. Ethan Hunt and by extension his team get framed. They have to uncover some kind of mystery, operate behind the shadows, go rogue. But it's a much bigger scale because these types of movies demand something more bombastic. And I don't know if audacious is honestly too strong of a word, because in the wake of not just what's happened here in this country, but worldwide, especially with a nation that we have a tumultuous relationship with at best, especially at that time, this was kind of... I was shocked they went to the extreme they did of literally just blowing up the entire building. I thought like just a window would get blown out or maybe they'd kill some general to make their escape. But no, they commit full-blown terrorism happens at the Kremlin. And I'm sure dozens, if not hundreds of people were hurt or killed.
Is this in poor taste, guys? We kind of talked about this when we talked about the real ending of The Running Man, when we talked about that movie, as opposed to what was in the book. Here, I don't think so. I think it's being done to very good dramatic effect, but some will kind of look at this as poor taste.
You know what? I'm sorry. We need to realize that the Russia fucking government are villains. Like, I know that's simplistic, right. But I'm sorry, man. You had somebody who put up a puppet president just so he could reinstall himself as president 4 years later in fucking Putin. So I'm not going to hold Russia up as somebody that we should safeguard. You know what? You eliminate Putin and you save tens of thousands of lives around the world. So fuck Putin. Fuck Russia.
All right. Adam wants
Come on, Rocky.
Adam wants Russia blown up. Matt?
I don't think it's in poor taste because the Russians are not the villains of the movie. They're victims and they have their own like agency. And I don't know what this guy is that shows up later, like what his job is, but they're involved in the story. They're not just a plot device to get the ball rolling. And there's actual consequence to it that leads to contention across not just the people in Russia, but how America is going to have to respond with IMF. I have questions about that momentarily, but I don't think this is bad taste. To me, it's not using 9/11 imagery in Man of Steel.
We cut to Ethan waking up handcuffed to a Russian hospital bed. Ethan is told that the real cause of the explosion was actually him. And then we see Ethan moving along a building on the outside. And I feel this scene is here just to kind of prepare us for what's coming later.
No, it's here to say, look at how good of shape I am for a guy who's 50.
Damn it, beat me to that. Yep.
And the fucking heights. Oh my God. Oh, I hate heights, and God, a scene in this movie in IMAX was fucking torturous to me. So Ethan pulls off his belt and rides the electric line down to the ground before getting up and running. Now, this needs to be said. At this point, when Mission Impossible had first started in 1996, yeah, we had Bond, but GoldenEye had come out the year before. At this point, Bourne is roaming around. Matt, do you think this is kind of bordering on mimicking Bourne?
No, because this has a sense of humor about it. And look, I like the Bourne movies. Maybe we'll talk about them at some point. But they're very much a response to 9/11 and where we were as a country and our relationship with government conspiracies and insight. This is, I don't think it's as dumb as like Fast and Furious, but it's sort of operating on that type of scale, especially around this time we had Fast 5 had just come out the same year. And I think these movies are pretty similar as far as like establishing what people really like. And kind of, I don't want to say picking up the pieces, but they had to reassemble some stuff and retool. And I think this is doing it. I don't think it's a response to Bourne as much. I'll say it's a response to Bourne as far as doing the other extreme. It's also a response to the Craig Bond films where we're not going to be so concerned with being realistic, but we're also not going to go into full-blown, like, super spy territory. I think it's a good balance.
Yeah, I think the nice thing that it does that Bourne can't do is it brings fun to it. Bourne is so self-serious. It's that John Le Carré, like everything is just so dour. You can't really have fun in those films. And I think that's why you can't last as a franchise. This reinvents, finds a way to have fun. I think that's the difference. But I do see that connection, especially the way that it's shot. And you get a few scenes, but it's not the film.
Ethan puts on a hoodie while he's in bare feet, and I feel this image was what was sold to us on the poster. Cruz in this hoodie. Pretty badass image, if you ask me.
Yeah, except they show him from the waist up in the poster. Although he does get boots. I think it's ridiculous. He apparently grabbed one pair of boots that fit him perfectly, but just happened to be sitting there.
They threw the 6-inch lifts.
Yeah, he got platform boots too, which makes it even funnier.
Yeah, no, it is a good, it's an effective shot, and I can still remember this poster, but I do think it is looking like a badass Bourne poster. It doesn't look like an MI poster, but it gets the point across, and it's a good look.
We see news footage of the Kremlin explosion as we cut to Ethan walking until he gets in a car with the secretary, played by Tom Wilkinson, as well as Brandt, played by Jeremy Renner. Now, this is an interesting role. Adam mentioned it. We thought that this was going to be the person who was going to take the reins of Mission Impossible from Tom Cruise, kind of like he was brought on the Bourne series to take the reins from Matt Damon. Both of those didn't work out for him. He's kind of the lackey, the Avengers as well. This role, you know, there's a few people who are up for this. Tom Hardy was a name that they had for a bit before he backed out. They wanted Chris Pine, and here's a name that I actually would have liked to have seen. Anthony Mackie was up for this. Renner just has no presence. He's just here. You know, I don't even feel like he's a member of the team, which I know that's kind of the point, but the lack of presence really hurts this role.
So I have a love-hate relationship with Jeremy Renner in the sense that I don't think he's a leading man. And unfortunately, I think he had to learn that the hard way with the Bourne, what was it called? The Bourne Legacy? Something like that, where it's not that he's a bad actor. I think he's actually a very good actor in most things. I just don't think he has that it factor or that star magnetism that you need to carry one of these big franchises. And I think his best roles are these type, where he's part of the team. You know, you made the cut, you made the roster, but you're not going to be the A guy. And I actually think his performance when he's purposefully trying to be more nebbish, I think works. When the reveal happens later on, he just goes into Hawkeye mode, right down to some of the jokes. Like, the way he reacts to shit is how Clint does in some of the Avengers movies. And I like him in those movies, but I think that's his level. I don't think he was ever going to be a big star.
He's always good when he's a big fish in a small pond, right? I think he's really good in The Hurt Locker, which is the only movie the movie that kind of exploded him onto the scene. And he was the lead in that, but that's where he excels, is in movies like that. These big ones, he just doesn't.
I think he's fine. I think he does what he's meant to do. He's not the star. I think they're trying to find out who he's going to be in this franchise. And I think almost like Benji last week, like Luther in the films before, it's let's see how he fits. And then we're going to decide after the film if he's going to stick around. And I think almost every character gets introduced that way. And some stick around, some don't. But I think the character and the way he plays them fits with who he's supposed to be. So I think he's fine.
So the secretary says that he's in Russia because a bomb blew up the Kremlin, and this is after he accepted an order of friendship from the Russians. Ethan goes over his plan, and the secretary says all plans went to hell when the Kremlin exploded because tensions between Russia and the U.S. are higher than ever. And Adam doesn't care. Here's something we haven't heard, boys. He also says that the entire IMF has been disavowed. Boy, where have we heard this before?
All right, well, this is the biggest plot hole in the movie, okay. And maybe the biggest plot hole in the series.
I'm going to say what I say. Yep.
So in all the previous movies, we are told that if an agent of the IMF is caught or killed, the government will deny any knowledge of their existence. So why is the president worried about bad publicity regarding an organization that they don't even acknowledge its existence?
Yeah.
Technically, they are disavowed until they are avowed. They're subcontractors. We don't acknowledge they exist, period. They don't work, they're not part of the CIA or the FBI. They are their own thing.
So he tells Ethan that he's been ordered to take him back to Washington unless he was to escape by assaulting Brandt and him. He says that if any of Ethan's team is caught, they will be labeled terrorists.
I love the look across Jeremy Renner's face as he's realizing
that
the secretary is explaining what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. This is his mission. The secretary says that he knows the sacrifices Ethan has made and has always considered him a friend. As the car is shot at and rolls into the water, Ethan tells Brandt to take deep breaths as they're shot at underwater. Brandt has a good line here. When Ethan asks him what he's doing here, Brandt just responds with, where else am I going to go? Of course, all of them miss Ethan by a long shot. Car is taken out as it gets out that both of them have escaped. So Brandt has a ton of questions, including, is this really happening? They start making their way through some trains before hopping on one following a retina scan.
Oh my God, I love this train sequence. This is the type of thing that's fun.
Yeah.
You know, all this just happened. They got to get into it. And the hopping up to try to, okay, I'm going to put in a code. Why doesn't it, hey, retinal scan.
Yeah.
Just jumping up, trying to do it. It's just, this. It's not needed, but damn it, bring some levity to the moment.
Yeah, you know, I also love how they have to run while trying to scan the retina just to add.
Yes.
So he hops on a train with his crew and Benji says that he thought Ethan was dead. We cut to Hendrix giving a speech as Ethan asks if they're sure this line is secure. I gotta say, man, bless his heart and God rest his soul, but Nyquist just has no presence as a villain here. I probably like this villain less than number twos.
Okay, the fun to be had is with the team. Everything else that happens, I don't find very good. I don't think the villains are good. I don't think the machinations are good. There's an entire back end of this film that isn't well done. And it's everything that doesn't have to do with the IMF team. They get back together. I like this. I like inside the train. This is badass tech. It's the only thing that kind of works. But everything regarding the antagonists, when you focus on them, you lose me.
Yeah, I think he's the worst villain of the entire series up to this point. He's got no presence. He also has no dialogue with Ethan Hunt throughout this entire movie.
I know. I noticed that when during this viewing. There is literally no interaction until the very end.
And I think this is where the writers that did this movie, you said they were Lost writers?
They're actually Alias writers.
Okay, Alias writers. I feel like if Brad Bird had a stronger hand in this, and I also know Christopher McQuarrie did some rewrites on this. Clearly, they didn't rewrite anything with the villains because they get nothing, and there's no scenes that really allow you to understand what it is they want or who they are. They are strictly here so that they can succeed to get the team to the next plot point. But they're not characters. Like they're not even they're not fun to watch. They're not interesting, and they have the personality of like Wonder Bread.
Ethan goes over the plan about what they're going to do with Hendrix. And then Ethan says that the intel indicates that she will check into a hotel in Dubai in 36 hours. He then says that Wistrom is an operative of Cobalt. For the launching device to work, Cobalt needs the activation codes, which he's sending Wistrom to in order to buy them from Moreau. And the president has evoked Ghost Protocol, and the four of them are what remain of IMF. A lot of exposition here, and Cruz delivers it so cheesily. This is a very cheesy speech.
Well, it's also so we're doing the same thing of the first one, where we have to get the two pieces together, because one doesn't work without the other. But I think he's also saying this exposition with a wink and a nod, almost like, yeah, we know this is silly, but just give us a minute and we'll get to the cool shit.
That's a good call. So Ethan says that their mission is Hendrix, as everyone connected to him should be considered valuable to their operation. The objective of the mission is to intercept the sale. They gear up, including the mask machine that we saw last week, even though that doesn't work either.
But I like that every movie, it is upping the mask machine a little. You see a little more every single film.
Ethan says that they're going to give the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world, a facelift with hopes of convincing two people they had a meeting, which actually never happened, and Benji calls Brandt the helper. Ethan almost hits a set of camels as they arrive at the Burj Khalifa. They enter the building and set up shop. And boys, I gotta say, I've had fun up to this point, but is it safe to say that everything in Dubai is the highlight of this film?
Maybe by default. I think it is from an action piece and from a directing piece. I gotta say, and it's not just because I'm a fan, but I think Brad Bird is actually doing a pretty stupendous job directing what's going on here. I think it is done really well in that regard. Awesome. Big credit to the editor. This looks fantastic. This is also just as convoluted as the Kremlin. It's they are writing themselves just a few. They're digging deeper than they need to when they're writing this. And it's, I think maybe what we got from the villain stuff not being rewritten was because this was rewritten, but the screenwriters, the ghostwriters, they think they're smarter than they are because they convolute the fuck out of everything.
There is no reason why they have to do this from the outside. It is ridiculous. That's where they're going with this.
From a stunt work standpoint, this is the highlight of the movie. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it has that problem where your best set piece makes the climax pale by comparison, so it doesn't fully succeed as a escalation later on. So in a way, it's the biggest compliment of the movie, but it's also kind of a problem. And I do have the issue of the overconvolution of, okay, why can't we use the elevator? Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? he gives two answers, and then they all decide to just scale the building, which I'm like, I wanted a more concrete reason as to why.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going with it because I'm having fun, but at the same time, there could... It's a giant fucking building. You couldn't come up with anything else.
And part of the reason I think we're here, and we see this start to be a big part of movies, is based on who's financing the film. And Skydance was put together by the son of Oracle's founder, you know, Ellison.
David Ellison.
And yep. And part of the money men in this is, was it Alibaba Productions?
Mm-hmm.
And much like a lot of Disney getting Chinese backers for a lot of their films nowadays, that means you got to have a scene in a major city based on where your financial backers come from. I'm not saying that takes away from it, because this film was sold on this scene alone. It was sold on Tom Cruise hanging from the outside of this building. But they found a reason to get here, and it's muddy.
Ethan's told the server is on the 130th floor, and we cut to them trying to break the glass, and Benji is helping Ethan learn how to use the climbing gloves. Brandt is our ticking clock as he says it's 26 minutes to door knock, and Ethan exits the building amongst a lot of wind and height. God, this fucking scene. Like, even like my big screen TV in my house, like I'm watching this going, holy shit, I can't watch scenes like this. Ethan climbs up as we're hearing the sound effects of the gloves working overtime or not working. And Ethan looks over and sees a dust storm approaching. Benji says, it's a long way off, so just keep going. And Jane can't believe where Ethan is as he almost falls. And again, just the scene of him outside this window from a long distance. Fucking A, man.
Looks great.
Also, he's doing this, the brunt of it, with one glove.
Yeah.
And I like they set up the rules just by showing, you know, the tech earlier on. So when it fails, we understand why and how. And that's a really nice job of the way that they do it. And yeah, even as much as I know he's not really on the outside, and I know this is tense as all hell, and I really have a good time with it.
One of the gloves stops working as Ethan says that he's at the server level and he starts to cut his way in. Ethan almost falls, and I love this call out by Ethan where he just yells at Brandt, the countdown is not helping. Again, Brad Bird is bringing a real sense of fun here. You can write a script and it can have fun in the script, but it takes a director to bring it out of people. And I will go right with Adam's buddy, Brad Bird. I think he's doing a tremendous job directing this thing, especially given that you're directing a big star, somebody who has been known to be difficult with some directors, but he's doing good things with them here.
First time.
So Ethan makes his way to the server room and then gets them all online. Benji takes control of the elevators and security cameras as Ethan is almost to Sabine before jumping out the window. And Brandt calls out the obvious by saying Ethan's line isn't long enough.
That's my favorite line read in the movie. Yeah, like,
No shit.
It is great. Ethan jumps, and I love this shot of his jaw just hitting the windowsill as we see Brandt just pull him up. Great stuff here. Benji says that it wasn't easy, but he did it. And then we see Brandt blink twice to activate the shutter as they spot Wistrom. Ethan asks for an exact copy of the launch codes as they've broken the case. Brandt and Ethan have a standoff, and the case with masks starts working. Ethan says Jane needs to go as the case is passed to Benji. And then we see Benji messing with the disguise equipment as there's a knock on the door and the tension is once again thick. Wistrom is identified as he tells Jane that he admires her work. At the same time, Ethan and Brandt, they meet with Sabine, and Jane orders tea from Benji as Ethan says that no codes, no diamonds. Sabine orders her thugs to get the papers as Wistrom says that the case is locked, the tea is tampered with, as Brandt goes through the fine print. Jane mistakes a combination for a key as the case is opened. Sabine gets the diamonds and they leave the launch codes. She says it was a pleasure doing business with you, as she also recognizes that Brandt's eye is a different color. Again, the tech not working. Ethan says that he needs Sabine alive, but Jane won't acknowledge it. Brandt takes out a thug, which impresses Ethan, who can't get in contact with Benji anymore. Jane tells Ethan to hold the gun to Sabine because if she has to do it, she'll kill her. We see the two guys from earlier catch up with Ethan and he apologizes as they pull their guns and he makes his way down the stairs, and we finally see this chick fight that we've been gearing up for this entire film.
This reminds me so much of when Michelle Rodriguez fights Ronda Rousey in Furious 7.
Oh God,
I think also also because it's, aren't they both in Dubai?
Yeah. Yep, I think they drive the car out of the same building.
Yeah. We see some slaps and punches as Jane kicks Sabine out the window. So this is what you mean, Matt, by Jane just not having it all together, right?
Yeah, she has her Luke Skywalker moment where she breaks.
Yes.
It's also like seeing violence against women in these action movies, even when it's women against girl on girl, is surprising. Not very often you see someone get kicked out of a window. Yeah.
I think her and Mace Windu have the record. I was not expecting Sabine to leave this film so early, though. Like, she's taken out here. It took me by surprise.
I didn't expect to see her come back. And I don't think she's doing anything other than showing up and looking constipated.
God, you have no passion for Lea Seydoux here.
No.
I think she's great, man. I love her glare. We see the crews run as he scurries away from the building. And, oh, by the way, a dust storm approaches. Remember this, guys? Benji mentions this like 20 minutes ago, and here we are.
This had to be Tom Cruise in a meeting going, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to outrun a weather event. Yeah.
Don't forget last week, he runs 16 miles per hour. Matt, how do you feel about this dust storm, sir?
It's putting a hat on top of a hat. You already had one of the most impressive stunts I've ever seen in a movie. Now you're going to add the elements because Tom Cruise has to prove he's stronger than God or at very least faster.
I will say, though, I do love this storm. I love when he pulls out the locator and is actually hit by a car. Like, that was a great moment.
This also starts the trend of Ethan Hunt and the IMF. From this movie on out, they are injected with rubber enzymes so they can be hit by cars and just bounce and get up and be okay.
Yep, they turn into Vin Diesel here. You might as well throw him off a building. I like the beginning of this, when he's got to put on the mask, when he pulls out the locator. But to do a car chase when you're just looking at a screen?
Yeah.
You lose the tension.
Hunt's trying to reach the guy in the car from the top of it, and he's just thrown off. The locator goes out, because every piece of equipment in this movie has to go out as Ethan takes a car. But despite that, you know, despite the way it ends, I still say that all this stuff in Dubai is great.
Well, here's the problem I have. So people besides the IMF have access to mask technology. How? Yep. The big reveal is it's Hendrix all along, and all we know is he was like former Swiss intelligence, but he doesn't have someone working on his team that used to be with the IMF. So how does he make something that realistic?
Well, how did some CD burners get out? How does any piece of equipment get out? You know, I mean, it's going to get released no matter what. I didn't really think too much about that. I just rolled with this. I could see this getting out.
You already did it in the second one because he was an ex-IMF agent. So at least he knows how it works. The third one, the villain doesn't use it. This one, some random terrorist knows how to use... how to make really convincing masks. This is something I never sits well with me.
Yeah, it's like he's in some type of rogue nation. Oh, shit. Nope, wait. Save that till next week.
Ethan keeps driving as he speeds up and goes head-on with the other car. He jumps out and then chases a shadowy Hendrix who jumps on a moving truck to get away. Brant yells at Jane about what the mission really was as Ethan is washing up. He gets a phone call and ensures that he's not going to be followed. He then springs out of the bathroom and confronts Brant, asking who he really is. And when Ethan tests him, Brant fights back like a true field agent. This was odd.
I like this. I like this back really? And forth. Yep. The stripping of the gun, the holding it. Nobody has done this with Ethan. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like it when it was done with Ambrose in 2, you know, the only person who would you kind of see as somebody on the other side of it. So I do like that he's not the only agent that's qualified.
Well, it makes him feel more human and less indestructible. He's not the super agent that can just be, you know, he's not Hulk Hogan being booked to just demolish everybody with no struggle. And you look at Jeremy Renner, I could buy him being able to fight Tom Cruise.
Ethan leaves and says that the plan was for them to bring Hendrix in together, and he needs to reevaluate that plan.
Wait, was that the plan? Because the whole point of the
That's what I thought.
The whole point of the previous sequence was to get the launch codes.
Exactly. Ethan walks up to a henchman and puts on a mask. And then we cut to Brant, who gives a speech about who he really is. He goes on and on and on about he was stuck in a position of should he or should he not warn a couple he was protecting about a Serbian invasion. He says the wife was found dead 3 days after an invasion, and that was the last time he was on the field. And that husband was Ethan Hunt, and the wife was Julia.
Did Phoebe Cates write this monologue?
This is bad. This was a Chris McQuarrie thing because he was brought in to kind of streamline this plot because it was all over the place. And this was the idea he had. And just how convoluted this gets to the point where at the end we actually see this chick alive just makes no fucking sense. And not to mention, I know you guys like Jeremy Renner in this. I do too. But the way he gives this does go up there with Phoebe Cates. This is bad.
Well, the problem is you could have had the same story and just never mentioned he was ever married.
Exactly.
It's part of the canon, if you're looking at this as a sequel, and you could have him have the final scene with his quote-unquote closure, or you could just have him say, oh, it didn't work. We realized it wouldn't work between us. Bad Robot's on here, but that's some mystery box bullshit, because they play the pronoun game of the couple.
I was just about ready to say, the couple is the whole pronoun game that you bitch about all the time.
I could see why they're trying to do it, because they're trying to bring some humanity to Cruz, but they're also trying to set up a future that they don't know what they want to do. So it's leaving it open-ended. I like it when it's being told, because I do want some melodrama in this. I want something, because I know that this is the first time we're getting a true sequel, you know, with Benji coming back and continuing directly. So I think it fits in that realm, because all the other ones have really been anthology standalones. And if you're going to continue this from a sequel standpoint, you got to address it. But we don't address Naya.
Yeah,
I guess you could have made this that story instead.
Brant says he has no idea how he's going to tell Ethan that it's because of him that Julia is dead. Or is she? Meanwhile, Ethan is interrogated by this guy he walked out of the prison with, and Hunt says that he's there to sell the future. He says the country is on the brink of a nuclear war, which isn't too good for business. He learns that the weapons aren't up for sale.
This movie gets really problematic from here on out. This whole thing, you got somebody who's got this, but he doesn't have this other part, so you're going to a third person who's going to bring you to a fourth person who has one part, who's going to then direct you towards a sixth person who's got a seventh part that should be readily available, but for some reason it's not. This scene where we bring Sergey back to tie some, this shit, the train derailed in the station, and this, whoever rewrote this part to try to find a fitting finale, missed the ball.
Well, the problem is these people would suck at putting puzzles together because nobody has enough pieces to make everything work. I'm fine with bringing Sergey back as a wraparound because that actually makes the opening.
Makes it matter.
I asked the question Benji asked, why'd you bring him? You know, it's not just because you're a nice guy.
Yeah.
So that part I'm fine with. But the whole third act of this movie, we bring in this other character we've never been introduced to, who's apparently in cahoots with the villain. It's amazing this movie functions as well as it does, much like the first one, because the plotting itself is really messy. But this one gets by more on just being fun than the first one does.
For sure.
Because it's not really asking you to take it as seriously as the first one does.
You could have had it where information that Sergey had was what the villain needed, and that's why Sergey was in prison.
Yeah, bringing in this Burge character out of nowhere is
for one scene.
Yeah.
For one scene, so just to say, I don't have it, but I know who does.
We cut to Hunt telling his team that they still have a chance to clear things up, and they have to do it together. And they make their way to India.
As a family.
God, I'm just going to fucking say it.
Everybody's taking each other's lines today. We see Ethan get ratted out, and the hunt is on for the nuclear device he stole from the Kremlin. Ethan gives Jane a pep talk about her ability to keep the launch codes from Hendrix. He also says he doesn't blame her for what happened. I like the fact that Jane is, you guys mentioned it, but she's more in the plot here than we've seen in the past. And she's having these withdrawals of what she did to really screw up this mission. And I like that Ethan's here to say, no, it's okay. I don't blame you. Benji and Brant, they get on trying to shut down the satellite and plan out exactly how they're going to do that. And this, of course, is also about setting up the magnet place that we're going to be going to here in a bit. Benji assures Brant that he'll catch him when he falls. What a nice car the team pulls up in here. This is so James Bond.
Oh, the shot of her getting out of the car is right out of a, that's out of a fucking Michael Bay movie.
Brant tells the team that he has arrived and the game of chess is on. Jane heads over to get the code. As Benji and Brant, they start their setup. Jane is approached by Burge, who welcomes her to his home. Brant stokes himself up for this jump, and he just can't seem to muster the courage to do so. Ethan tells him to jump no less than 5 times, which he finally does. Meanwhile, Ethan approaches Jane, saying that he's playing a hunch, and kisses her. Because Cruz has to kiss the leading lady here.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's bad enough you already have Hindu Weinstein in the scene. And you have to add this.
Hindu Weinstein. Burge calls her to say that he'd like to show Jane his art collection. Meanwhile, Benji is giving Brant some directions. Brant is at the control panel as Hendrix walks in. Jane grabs Burge and pulls him down before slapping him, and that looks like a good time to me, boys.
I mean, would.
Hendrix requests the virus to be downloaded to the satellite server, as Jane is now on the clock to get the code. She wrestles Burge down and interrogates him for the codes. He gives them, and she knocks him out. Meanwhile, Brant gets stuck in the air shaft, and Benji says that he can't do anything about it, but Brant is able to maneuver out of it. And then we see Hendrix request them to upload the new launch codes as Ethan gets the route to him on his windshield screen. Ethan is given 3 minutes to get there, even though according to Jane, he's 3.5 minutes out. The suspense is now on as if he's going to get there. as he's stuck in traffic, and we get this sort of weaponized Death Star set of scenes as buttons are pressed and missiles are launched.
This is the ending of War Games.
Yeah. I just rewatched that like 2 weeks ago.
The end of War Games, and because of its placement, it's also the end of The Rock.
Yeah, that's a good call too. Ethan says that they're going to get the case as he finds Hendrix and starts the chase. Jane gets in a gunfight and notices that she's shot. We see the satellite separate in space as we get another cruise run and jump. And at this point, Mikhail Nyquist just doesn't have a chance, does he?
I don't know why we are here.
I know.
I understand. Like, I know what they're telling me. But one, this house that we went to, this guy's not a villain. Paula Patton could have went up and asked for it and he would have given him to her. You know, he's not a bad guy. And guess what? In the time this was written, what, 2011? Mm-hmm. I think this is when this one. Satellites aren't hard to come by. There's thousands of them up there. This is a plot point in fucking so many movies. So I don't know. Oh my God. This ending is just, it was one too many, two ago. So this is just, oh shit.
Yeah. And why why does the final fight take place in an Audi garage?
Oh my God, this fucking CarMax car delivery. Yeah, I see one of these car vending machines every day in Daly City.
I wanted to play that Super Mario theme as they were jumping up and down these platforms.
Fucking Donkey Kong.
Yes. Ethan knocks Hendrix around before jumping down the shaft of cars. Matt, did it also remind you of Total Recall from the year after? They had a kind of a scene like this.
Oh, shit, with Colin Farrell. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Ethan grabs the briefcase before Hendrix catches up to him, but the case falls into another platform. Brandt is met by another henchman, and Hendrix grabs the case and for some reason just jumps to his death. Like, this was odd.
I'll say kind of frightening.
This is so dumb.
Frightening, you said?
Yeah, just that he's an absolutist. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just like, I don't care if I die as long as everybody else does. He's a true believer.
You're inferring a lot about his motivations.
Exactly. You're giving the script a lot more credit than it deserves.
And also, this would work if they established, like, it was a voice-activated suitcase so nobody could get in.
You're teeing it up, but I don't know when Tom Cruise visited a vehicle testing facility, but starting with this film, he gets a hard-on for airbags.
Yes. I was just about ready to get to it. So Ethan gets in a car and takes a plunge before landing and setting off an airbag. More footage of the missile in the air as Ethan crawls to the case and opens it as Hendrix opens his eyes. So he wasn't really dead. We're seeing a countdown as...
No, but his eyes were wide shut.
You guys are just on a roll today. We're seeing a countdown as Benji, of all people, shoots the henchman who's holding Brandt, saving him in the process. Ethan hits the case and breaks the code as we see the missile just come this close to causing major damage. And
it's just a scratch, but it takes off a whole top of that fucking building.
Yeah.
Nobody felt that shit?
I was going to say, where's the fucking America news building? Footage of that?
Those are offices up there, people.
Yes.
And nobody saw that coming towards them?
I know. Ethan is met by other operatives who verify that they aren't enemies. You know, boys, we've gone all through this movie. And I'm like, where's Luther? I remember being in the theater saying, okay, well, I guess they're not going to bring Luther here. But we cut to Seattle where Ethan has a conversation with Luther.
And Luther, thank God, I guess he read my notes. He calls out Tom Cruise for saying the stupidest shit.
Yeah, saying mission accomplished. I thought that was great.
I love that they call it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it happens, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they did it. But that they make it a joke that they realize completely buys it back.
I also thought that they were bringing Luther back so he could be the new secretary. I thought that's what the purpose of this was.
That's a jump. The group approaches and we're hearing that the insurance company is refusing to pay for the car that Ethan crashed. And I do like the repartee between this team. You know, we mentioned it earlier, but this team, Matt, is it safe to say this is the best team they've assembled?
Yeah, and it makes me curious to see them like come back, which I never really felt with the like three. If they never brought back Jonathan Rhys Meyers and Maggie Q, I would have not lost sleep over it.
Yeah,
but I like these people enough to where I kind of want this to be the status quo. Although this ending is straight out of fucking Fast Five, they might as well all be drinking Coronas instead of Dos Equis.
I like Ethan acknowledging that the team working together is why the crazy plan they did actually worked. The team disbands as Brandt tells Ethan about how he failed to protect Julia. But we see a boat pull up, conveniently, as Julia walks off with some co-worker. Now, this was a rewrite. Originally, she was dead in the original script, but McCrory came on and said, you know what? That would be a downer of an ending. People don't want to see her dead. We want to see her alive. I get that, but are they married? Are they not? Are they just acquaintances now? Like, this was so bizarre. Do they operate separately and they only meet up like once a year? What is going on here? Nothing is established. Everything about this sucks.
Nope. Everything about this is nice. Wow. Because at the end of three, he says, you know, I'm going to tell you everything. And I assume he did. And this is one of the, without spelling it out, it's kind of like, you need to go off and live your life to be safe. You know, whether she's in the MI witness protection program or, well, save it for future because she's not hidden. But I like that she didn't die, but he can't have her for her own safety. If you killed her, it would have been diamonds or forever. You know, so it's, you did a different way to do it. And he has to suffer that he can't be with her. And based on that, you know what? You're not going to give Cruz another woman in this franchise. So I think you kind of kill two birds with one stone, and it works out.
She apparently has jungle fever here too. Matt, how do you feel about Julia being alive here?
I'm fine with her being alive. I would have just liked, it's the fucking Dark Knight Rises ending where you can read it however you want. that kind of, so I did get the movie I was planning to see 6 months beforehand. It's fine. I appreciate the ambiguity. I'm glad they didn't fridge her, because that would have been, that would have upset me, because I'm like, you did a whole movie where you tried to humanize Ethan Hunt, and then you go back on it after you already put in the work. So I think it's fine, but I do like the true ending note this movie leaves.
Ethan says that he pulled Brand's file and says that it wasn't his job to protect Julia, it was his. They then both verify that they're good as Ethan makes stalker eyes to Julia. She locks eyes with him and smiles before heading in. And then we see Ethan walk and receive another mission about something called the Syndicate, which we'll talk about next week.
Which you could hear all the old timers in the audience go, oh.
Yeah, exactly. As he walks into the smoke and credits roll on Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, boys. Wow. Animated discussion. How do we feel? Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol? Adam.
Animated discussion from an animated director. This, and with that animated director, this thing is laid out very well. You could tell that they really planned this thing around action sequences. Again, I think that hurts in some respects. I think it helps in some respects because the action sequences are gorgeous and they're what you come for. I think there's one too many, but you got to start putting some work into your script if you want it to be a smart spy film. But on the bright side, this one isn't preoccupied with that. We get the team back together and we're going to have fun more than we did before. I mean, last week's film, I love MI3, but it is it's brutal. You know, it is forceful. This one, it is a lot more bright. It is a lot more about the gadgets, even when they don't work. It's about the team working together and the spy craft and everything that goes along with it. Don't come for the plot, because it is as thin as the soles on Tom Cruise's running shoes. It's you're going to hurt yourself trying to figure it out. It's less defined than the rabbit's foot, but that's okay, because I like seeing this team together. I really have fun with Benji coming back. I think Paula Patton is a damsel that's not in distress, which is a nice thing to see in these kind of films. I just wish by the end of this that they had either cut the last sequence or put more thought into why it mattered. Overall, this is a nice continuation. You once again changed up your formula for a formulaic film series, and that blows my mind. Four films in, four completely different types of films, and if they're not getting better, at least after two, they're not getting worse. I think this is a nice debut for Brad Bird in the live action realm. And I think Tom Cruise returns to this franchise now with a purpose and with a passion. And I'm excited to see where it goes. It's not great, but damn, it's good. This is a solid 7. It's a good time. Just don't think too much about your Russian intrigue, because that'll let you down. But yeah, 7 on 10. Really good time with Ghost Protocol.
Solid 7 from Mr. Bunch. Matt, what about you, sir?
God, I don't like all the symmetry. Did George Lucas direct this? Because I think everything Adam said, I co-sign. And I'll start with the final score. I do give this a 7 as well, for almost the same reasons that Adam did. I do think that while it operates on pure escapism and does that the best of this franchise up to this point, I wanted a really strong villain. And for an action franchise, they're 1 for 4 in that regard. So not a good batting average. And I think if I enjoy seeing the heroes as much as I do, I kind of want to see them go up against something I actively hate, or at least ambivalent towards. because that would at least make me feel something, which I don't with this fucking Hendrix character, who was the biggest stiff I have seen since watching Jeff Jarrett bury WCW in 2000 when he was world champion. So I'm going to give it a 7. I think Brad Bird really does bring a vibrancy to the tone and to the action scenes that is befitting of this type of spectacle. I just wish, and I think this would have been a lot of the issues we talked about would have been fixed if he co-wrote the movie. But as it is, it's a damn good time. And up to this point, I do think it's the best of the series.
God, you hate the symmetry. I hate all the agreeing that we're doing on this podcast. When I went to this movie, I got to be honest, I wasn't really expecting much. This movie was sold on Tom Cruise being on that building and everything around him. But at the same time, we need a solid villain. And while I didn't really like last week's villain, I liked the actor playing the villain, there was no freaking depth to this villain whatsoever. And as a result, there's no depth to this film. The movie is about as dumb as a Transformers film, plot-wise. But when I watch these scenes, I am having a blast watching these scenes and going through them and having the Simon Pegg one-liners hit me left and right, and even Cruise with his line deliveries. All of this just seems like a fun time, and I want to credit Brad Bird with that. I think he brought something that the series really needed. At this point, the series was so self-serious. We needed to bring some lively fun, and that's exactly what Brad Bird did. I'm glad it was a one and done. I wouldn't have liked him to come back, but for this one film, I had a blast, so I am also going to go with a 7. But even after that, I knew there was room to improve. Adam, what are you expecting next week when we talk about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
I think this was the one where I remember people saying MI had finally found its full footing and was becoming one of the best spy franchises that was out there. I haven't watched it in a while. We'll discuss who I remember, because I think y'all will throw it in my face as soon as we start the recording of it. But there's certain parts, certain people addition that I think have stuck out massively in the benefit to this franchise. But yeah, I think this is the one where people said, holy crap, this has surpassed Bond.
All right, Matt, next week we get to Christopher McQuarrie's directorial debut when it comes to this series. What are you expecting next week when we talk about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
Well, my excitement for it at the time was about as level as I was for Ghost Protocol. I was a fan of Christopher McQuarrie's work as a director, which we'll talk about because it does tie into Tom Cruise, ironically. But I couldn't bring myself to get amped up about it because I had Kingsman that year. I had Bond that year. I was getting my spy fill one way or another. And this just felt like, oh, they're making another one. I'm sure it'll be fine. But I wasn't expecting anything on the level, let's say, like Mad Max Fury Road, which came out a couple months before this and kind of set the bar unfathomably high for that summer. But I've seen it a couple times, and I'm curious to go back to it because I know McQuarrie's the guy for the rest of this series. You know, he's kind of the David Yates, not just because he took over at the fifth movie.
All right, and that'll be next week. And before we sign off, I did want to mention that a guy that the three of us have worked for, and the guy I've been friends with for almost as long as I've been friends with Adam, quite honestly, David Main, has just released his second book called Zoo. It is sitting right on my counter. I have about 250 pages left to go in it, but I'm going to get to this one eventually. If you like sci-fi, if you like weird Philip K. Dick type shit, this book is for you. It's about 400 pages. Adam, we can't be more happy for Dave, can we?
Very happy for Dave. I'm excited to get the book in my hands and read it. I really enjoyed his first book, first novel. So yeah, this one, for those that don't know, absolutely. Reach out, get it, judge for yourself, but I think you'll be happy.
Yeah, the three of us worked with him at the Adventure Amigo site, and he's one of the hardest working and one of the most creative people I've ever met. And not only is he making music, he's writing books. Couldn't be happier for Dave, and yeah, go pick that up. But until next week, boys, when we talk Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Thank you, boys.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Go!
It's Benji. Where am I going?
They're coming.
We're not ready.
Then get ready.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You can understand you're very upset. Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Your line's not long enough!
No shit!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So let me get this straight. When there's a mission none of you can handle, you just leave word for a nameless man and hope he gets the job done. Is that it?
Should he choose to accept?
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I am waiting.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon series, the movies of the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park,
the ongoing Marvel series,
and so many more.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
He made it! He made it!
I knew he'd make it.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Scheduling by Matt.
Read this. Slowly.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Listen. Talk to me. We can talk. Like gentlemen.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Reggie, did you recover anything?
Yes. Despite the aforementioned conditions of the hard drive you brought back,
I managed to recover portions of 24 email files. Also made what I believe to be a thoroughly promotion-worthy breakthrough.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You wanted me to listen. This is me listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
That was not easy, but I did it.
I almost bought tickets for this nine-inch, the Trent Reznor Festival, but goddamn, they're expensive. I was like, nope, change. Why? Because it's an all music. It's a score. It's literally
so
fucking.
What? Like, it's a fucking it's music score. Of the movies. Oh my god. It's,
the people they have, he's got everybody but Hans Zimmer showing up to
his this music thing. Scores suck. It, all of his music scores suck. Like, they're all ambient sounds. Like, there's no fucking emotion attached to them whatsoever.
Not anymore.
I was watching a documentary on, I think it was Lollapalooza, and, like, I was watching his first appearances at Lollapalooza. God damn, that guy was a fuck. He was awesome at one time, and now it's just like, oh, I won an Oscar, so I'm just going to do these music scores that all pretty much suck and have, like, no fucking rhyme or rhythm to them. Yeah, I'm not a Nine Inch Nails fan anymore. With Teeth was my breaking point with him. I'm like, this sucks, and you're never going to be good again, so fuck you. Once he became happy, he was done with me. But all right. Does he even tour anymore as Nine Inch Nails, or do you just do music scores now?
I am seeing him in August.
But you said he's doing the music scores, right?
So Nine Inch Nails goes on tour, but he's doing just a festival in LA, and it's for film composers. So it's Trent and Atticus Ross putting on this festival. But no, Nine Inch Nails goes on tour, and it's like, to me, that's where I found the difference for the Tron soundtrack, is it's not Trent and Atticus, it's Nine Inch Nails. So it's kind of like Tool in a perfect circle to me.
Did they do the score for Tron Legacy?
Yeah. No, not Legacy.
They're doing the new one.
Yeah, the Legacy had a good one.
The only scores of theirs I liked were Soul and Girl with...
Social Network I thought was Social great. Network.
Those are the only two ones I really liked.
Intro to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was awesome. Though I don't know. I'm still offended that they won it for Soul when you had black artists doing music, but not the score.
Well, didn't they cover Immigrant Song for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Yeah. They did it with Karen O, who I have a lot of respect for. Well, I did until that.
I mean, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo technically connects to this movie, so everything's... synchronized.
Oh, I love Karen O. God damn. Okay. Right, Trent Reznor thinks he's John Williams all of a fucking sudden. God damn it. Fuck. And yours, Matt? What time's yours?
10 p.m. So I'm not getting out of there until like 1 in the morning.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, assuming they start on time, which they never do.
Yeah, they never do.
Minutes behind, and there's going to be 20 minutes of fucking trailers. I'm going to have to watch Nicole Kidman preach to me for 5 minutes. I'm going to have to get the fire code announcement. I'm going to get plugs for the fucking burger stand on the other side of the theater.
It does always make me laugh when I'm seeing a Tom Cruise movie and get to see Nick, like, do the intro.
See Nick. Like, you know her on a first name basis. Just stop it.
Oh, that was just
fucking
for you.
Fucking A. God, get me fucking pissed off already. Jesus. See Nick.
Oh, yeah, I've never been to SeaWorld, but I've heard that their coasters are just...
Oh, their coasters are badass.
I sent you the picture last year. I'm like, I can't believe they have as many roller coasters as they do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's to combat all the negative publicity. All right. Well, speaking of combating negative press, Tom Cruise fits into this equation.
He sure does. Okay. 2011, Adam, you said that you only went to this because it had a preview for Dark Knight Rises. That's true.
That was me.
Oh, was that Matt. You? I thought Adam said that.
Nope. Okay. I know us young white guys look the same.
Matt.
And yeah, Tom Cruise going full Harvey Weinstein is some of the funniest shit to me.
You said they couldn't do it nowadays. Have you listened to Robert Downey Jr. when he told his mom he was going to do it?
No.
She goes, Bobby, I'm telling you, I got a really bad feeling about this.
Channeling her Han Solo, huh? And then he did a movie, which I believe to be Adam's favorite movie, Night and Day, with his favorite actress, Cameron Diaz. That is one that, believe it or not, I did see that. I saw it in theaters, and God, is it bad. It is so bad. Matt, did you see Night and Day? Matt, are you there?
I'm just going to use the bathroom. I'll be right back.
Okay. All right. We'll wait. We see news footage of the Kremlin explosion as we cut to Ethan walking until he gets in a car with the secretary, played by Tom Atkinson. I forgot he was here.
Wilkinson, sorry.
Played by Tom
Atkinson. Atkins would be very different.
Yes. Secretary, played by Tom Wilkinson.